It was an immense privilege to catch up with Canon Dr. William Price. Now, William taught me about 25 years ago when I was an undergraduate at the University of Wales in Lampeter. And William talks about the time that he went to Lampeter in 1970 as a history lecturer and worked there for another 27 years. He now lives in Wem, Shropshire, which is where I met up with him in Christmas 2018. He talks about reading history at Keble College, Oxford. He talks about being attracted by Lampeter's Anglican tradition. It was a chance to revive his Welsh. He talks about Lampeter being a unique town. We find out what William's earliest memories were, including walking by the sea in Colwyn Bay in early 1947. He talks about his first day at school. We find out about why his local village school teacher said that they couldn't teach him anymore. He talks about the role that piano music played in his youth. He played the organ when he was in church and sometimes still does to this day. He's got no interest in sports. He talks about how TV was the main form of entertainment when he was growing up. He remembers watching the Queen's coronation in 1953. He talks about how his O-level art teacher summed up his O-level as the triumph of intellect over ability. We find out what he did at A-level and how things may have been very different if he'd had a different teacher. We learn whether William's memories are predominantly positive. He reflects on what might have happened if he had ridden just one horse rather than two horses, in the sense that he has followed academic and clerical professions over the years. We learn which of the two professions he ultimately chose and why he has no regrets about the choices he has made. If he had his time again, would he have made the same choices? We discover why William is mentally very curious, why he is a looking forward type of person, and why his family is at the centre of his life. So an immense privilege to catch up with Canon Dr. William Price. My name is Chris DC. Welcome to the latest in my series of Nostalgia Interviews. Well, it's my pleasure to be a guest of Canon William Price, or William Price.
Canon Doctor.
And of course, you taught me a long time ago when I was an undergraduate in Lampeter, 91 to 94. So an absolute pleasure to meet you again after so many years.
Mutual.
So I think you said just before we started recording that you moved to Lampeter in 1970.
Yes.
And was that as a history lecturer?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because I knew you both in history and in theology, religious studies. But that was very much your area. So church history?
General history. I think there are only about four of us in the department. And I was teaching, for instance, I still remember this, I was teaching British history from 1603 to 1889, I think, and various other things as well. And then gradually the department increased, and eventually I was able to teach only 18th century Britain and 18th century Europe, and some Welsh history. And then gradually over the years too, I got involved teaching church history. And, well, it must have been before you got there, because you had to somehow have your work assigned in sort of proportion. And I think it was 0.75 history and 0.25 theology or something. So the 0.25 theology was actually what I got to like most in the end, which was alternate years, liturgy and Anglicanism. So, yeah, I started off just as a lecturer in history and then got, after a bit, senior lecturer. And then theology was added.
Yes, and the thing that I most remember is the disestablishment of the church in Wales. And of all the topics that I wrote essays on, I think, because when it came to writing that particular assignment in my final year, I knew nothing about the topic, but after a couple of weeks of research, I would hardly call myself an expert, but I thought, well, actually, I've done the research, I've looked at the evidence, I mean, I've forgotten the arguments now, but it felt like what a wonderful way to learn, to go to the library, to do some research, and then write 3,000 words, and sort of feel that you could be a mini authority on something for a few weeks.
Yeah.
And that was what stood out mostly from all my studies in 3 years at Lampeter.
Oh, right. Yeah, I think Lampeter was quite a good place for that, because with the library, because Lampeter itself, of course, the staff had been so involved at the time of disestablishment. So, and once talking about, well, you're from Cardiff, of course, talking about places you knew. But it's funny, because it's been with me ever since. I mean, I wrote, though I left Lampeter in 1997, I'd still been writing still, and I did a published a book a couple of years ago, a chapter on Diocese of St David's and disestablishment. And now I'm writing a chapter on a book to commemorate the centenary of disestablishment in 2020. So I'm not getting away, even though I live in England, I'm not getting away from. Yeah. And for quite a long time, I just finished, actually. I was, what was my title? Advisor on Archives to the Church in Wales. And so I've been very involved. Mm-hmm. But yeah, disestablishment is interesting, and in my family, apart from my paternal, the Prices, all the rest of my family are all Welsh Presbyterians or Calvinistic Methodists, so there's a sort of family thing about that.
Yeah, yeah. My background was very Anglican Church in Wales, yeah. and that was my route to from a church school to...
That's
to
right, but my mother's family and then even my paternal grandmother, they were all Calvinistic Methodists. And going back to the tithe wars, which were part of disestablishment in... I've forgotten about this, really, till you mentioned it. It's kind of why it's come to mind. In the 1880s, when farmers were rising up against tithe to the Anglican parson, in one parish, one of my forebears was the leading farmer against the church, and the other forebear was the church warden in the same parish. So there's a nice family sort of link there, really, with it. But, yeah, I enjoyed Welsh history.
Yeah. But going back a little bit further first, I mean, how did you end up in Lampeter? Or you know, because you're from Shropshire originally.
I'm Welsh. I'm Welsh speaking. Born in Colwyn Bay. Lived in Anglesey and then in Carnarvonshire. And then it was a long time ago, when I was 1947. When I was three, my father's a curate and then a vicar. We moved when I was three to Shrewsbury, just down the road from here, and 3 years later to a village called Hadnall. And I was in grammar school here, where I live now in retirement in Wem. I'm Shropshire by adoption, I suppose, but still prefer to think of myself as Welsh. And then, of course, I went back then and lived for 30 years in Wales, Lampeter and Kidwelly. But why did I go to Lampeter? Mm. Right, well, I went from Wem Grammar School to Oxford, to Keble College, and read history. And then I did a bit of research for a B.Lit, though I never actually finished it. Partly because I got a bit bored with it, but partly because the supervision was about half an hour a term, I got a job as assistant editor of the Victoria County History of Shropshire, a standard history. You've come across the VCH, I'm sure, I was quite happy doing VCH work. Working in the county archives in Shrewsbury. And then one day the assistant archivist, Marion Horford, said, "Oh, there's an advert here for a job in Lampeter." I said, "Why don't you have a go?" So she let me. She was trying to get rid of me, but she actually gave me a stamp to send off for particulars. And I was shortlisted and went down to Lampeter and got the job.
Mm. And certainly when I was there in the early 90s, there were a number of staff who'd been there, possibly even from the 60s. I'm thinking in the classics department, Tony Brothers. Yeah.
Well, the big expansion was in the early 60s when Lampeter got state funding and expanded a great deal. So, yes, I mean, I'd been to Lampeter. I knew what Lampeter looked like just as a visitor. But I quite liked it, and I mean, it was, I suppose, in size, it's a bit like Wem, really. It's a sort of small town. I was attracted by the Anglican tradition, though it's pretty weak by 1970. But it was still, I mean, College Chapel and so on. Principal who was a priest. I was attracted by, but above all, I was attracted by a chance to. how can I put it, to revive my Welsh. Because until we came to Shrewsbury when I was three, round about four, when I was about four, I made a conscious decision not to speak Welsh. And up to then, I could only speak Welsh. I mean, grown, you know, the early years in Anglesey. And I still can't, I can still almost remember taking this decision that Welsh somehow was a second-rate language. And I think Anglesey Welsh can be pretty crude. I was living in England now, a four-year-old. School was all going to be in English, and, you know, all the people I knew spoke English. And I just refused to speak Welsh. Though both my parents are Welsh-speaking, so Welsh was quite a language of home. But I wouldn't speak it, and I didn't speak it. I understood it, because, I mean, you can refuse to speak a language, but you can't refuse to understand them. Mm. And Welsh radio was on at home all day, and so on. So I think it was. I mean, I was happy working in the county history, and I did. At one point, I was doing four evening classes a week when I was not married then. In the county history, which it's quite a lot of money actually, but that was good for lecturing. Mm. And I was dealing with adults on local history around Shropshire, and that was a good testing ground for teaching. But I think I think above all, Lampeter was because I wanted to be in a community where Welsh was spoken.
Yeah, because growing up, as I did in Cardiff, it was so English-speaking. Mm. The Welsh that we did hear and which we studied in school was done in such a way that, you know, it wasn't as anybody who spoke native Welsh, shall we say, would speak it. It was very much Radio Cymru, Radio Wales. We would BBC Welsh. And so when I went to Lampeter, I found that I wasn't able to pick up on the dialect in the way that I'd studied it.
I mean, my family are all from North Wales, so the Welsh I heard but wouldn't speak was all North Wales dialect.
But, and yet I feel more Welsh sometimes when I'm in Canterbury, particularly when I encounter a fellow Welsh student, because maybe because of the way I sound, I don't sound particularly Welsh, and yet I feel very proud of being Welsh when I'm in exile almost in the southeast of England.
Yeah.
And actually, when I was living in Herne Bay, I did describe it to someone who was at Lampeter, saying, well, it's actually quite similar to Lampeter in terms of the size, and you haven't got any big stores, you don't have a McDonald's or a Burger King but I also said it has the sea and it has a cinema. I thought, well, actually, so not like Lampeter then.
Not quite.
So Lampeter is unique.
yes. Well, it is. Have a small town with a university in it. Probably the smallest university town, I think, in the country, and where the at least when it was at its best, the number of students must have been almost the same as the population of the town. So the only other place I can think of like that might be St Andrews. I was living, I wasn't married when I went there. I was living in a building since demolished called Canterbury Building, the old Canterbury Building. And four nights a week, Monday to Thursday, I went to the castle with a chap called Idris Reynolds. Was he in the library?
Oh, he was, yes.
Who was later became a crowned or a chaired bard of the estate. Unless I was doing something else, I mean, we spent an hour in the castle having a drink and speaking Welsh and no English at all. And that, you know, I was at that time, I wasn't ordained then, but I was a lay reader in the church. And within 6 weeks, I was taking services in Welsh and preaching. Because this silly thing about not speaking it, but I could understand Welsh and I could read Welsh and I could write Welsh. So, you know, it came back very quickly. And that was... I think if the assistant archivist had shown me a cutting for a job in another university, I might not have been so interested. though I suspect, had it been Aberystwyth or Bangor, similarly for linguistic reasons, and being in Wales, I might. But Lampeter just suited me. An Anglican foundation in a Welsh-speaking...
I think a lot of people find it's community. In their DNA. It's like the old adage, you can take the boy out of Lampeter, but you can't take Lampeter out of the boy.
Right.
And I feel like that. I'm very proud of my time at Lampeter. Even the place may be very different now to what it was, but what I learnt there, the skills, not least educationally, I think, and also growing up in a small town where there was a sense of community and you did see the same people all the time. It wasn't as anonymous as it can be in bigger city universities. And I think it was a really privileged place to go for my undergraduate studies.
So. Yeah, because you couldn't avoid people sometimes you would have liked
to. It did work both ways, you're right.
You would have liked to have done, but... and there's camaraderie among the staff too, really, because it... I certainly, when I went there, and for a lot of my time there, actually, early on, I mean, I knew every academic colleague by name, which you wouldn't in most universities. Some of them were birds of passage. I mean, Lampeter was just a stepping stone. But I think you either stayed there a year or two and got another job, or you never left.
That was my perception. There were some colleagues who'd been there. For decades, and it was a privilege to meet them because there were generations before who would speak. So, as is the case with you, I went to the Lampeter reunion in the summer, and of course, because you'd been there for 27 years, there were many generations of students who'd known you. But on the other hand, there were some people who, as you say, I mean, I know people even at Kent who passed through Lampeter, but I don't remember them. They'd maybe been there a year taught there for a small period, and as you say, it was a stepping stone. It happens in all universities, but particularly apparent in a place like Lampeter, where there is a community, and some people clearly spent longer in that community than others. What about earliest memories? How far can you go back?
What, in life?
In life,
well,
yeah.
What else,
when you were young. What can you remember from growing up in North Wales, or indeed when you moved to Shropshire?
Well, I was three, wasn't I, when we moved to... Because my father was a curate, I can work out where I was any... I was born in Colwyn Bay, 1943, and within 6 weeks, we'd moved to Anglesey, Llangefni, which in Welsh terms would have been a better place to have been born than Colwyn Bay, but I was premature. And then we were there in Llangefni until 46, summer of 46, till I was three. And then we moved to Penman Mawr. But we were only there about 8 months, I think, and then to Shrewsbury. I have two memories of Llangefni. So this would be before, this would be when I was two, I suppose. One is, and that they are inconsequential, and they may, in fact, never have happened. One is playing in the garden with friends on a summer's day, and I can see it now. And the other is curious in that I think it must perhaps, because my father's a curate there, somebody very important came, and it might have been the Bishop of Bangor, I don't know. But in the living room in the house in Llangefni, the mantelpiece, the fireplace, was a sort of Norman arch. It was round, and I can still see that. And this gentleman coming through the door, and that's Llangefni, all right. And then I was three, and we moved to Penman Mawr. I can remember going to church in Penman Mawr to St Saerial's, now closed. And two things I can remember about that. Why can you? I mean, this is your field, isn't it? Why can you remember just one thing out of a whole year, really?
I think they're often composite memories, though.
Yeah, I'm sure they are.
I'm sure that there are things, and it may be true of even time at Lampeter. When you I mean, I've always kept a diary. Well, I say always, since the age of nine, but particularly since Lampeter. So at least I can corroborate some things.
Right. Well, the St Saerial's, I remember going and getting in the service One is that one of the clergy was very old and was in a wheelchair or something. I can still see that. And the other is that I got hold of the hymn books and prayer books and put them on the ledge. It was on a train, you see. Of course, they all fell off. So I suppose that's... And then the other is walking by the sea, which would have been probably February, March 47. Why I can remember walking by the sea then, I can't remember what happened before or what happened afterwards. I mean, February, March 1947 was actually a terrible winter. But of course, Penmanmaur being by the sea, North Wales coast, it was presumably less, it's milder there than elsewhere. But that's as much as I can remember.
Mm. Now, one of my earliest memories is having my hair washed. So water seems to be a common link.
Oh, yes, the sea, there we are. And then, I mean, I suppose the one I can almost date is a month before I was four, in July the 22nd, 1947, my sister was born. And I can remember my sister, my mother bringing my sister back from the maternity. They had things called, what was it, maternity homes or something then, where ladies went to have babies. Yeah. So I could almost date that as something like July the 24th, 1947.
And they were often in there, of course, for up to 2 weeks.
Well, they could be. So it could be. That's why I haven't got a date. I think it was quite straightforward. But I can still remember. I think my parents didn't have a car then. So I think it was a black taxi. And there was this baby at the back who was my sister. Then after that is going to school, isn't it? I can remember the first day. Now, this may be anecdotal that has sort of developed since. No, it isn't, because it's through my mother's memory, repeated to me. So it would be September 1948. Featherbed Lane, it's a funny name, Featherbed Lane Primary School in Shrewsbury. And I went to school. And when I got back, I said to my mother, "I've been to school today, what do I do tomorrow?" And she repeated that so often to me that I presume I did say it. Mm. And when I was doing school end of term things for schools, that was an anecdote which I always which I always came out with.
Mm. No, I was in a curious position because my birthday's in June. Mm. I was only in school for mornings only.
All right.
At the age of four. And so at 12 o'clock, I'd have to be picked up. And then all my friends were still in school till the afternoon. So I couldn't quite work out why I had to leave my friends at 12 o'clock and then be picked up, sometimes by a different person, because it had to fit around my dad's working schedule. So it was quite disruptive, actually, from their point of view. I can see now how disruptive it would have been. But yeah, so I sort of enjoyed school, but kind of felt that I was part-time.
Right. Well, my birth is in August, at the end of August. So, in fact, I've never had to go to school on my birthday, or indeed work on my birthday, really, and till I became a vicar when I once had a wedding on my birthday, but that's another matter. But in those days, in 1940s, I mean, I don't think people on the whole went to school till they were five. Right. And there was no nursery provision at all. So, in fact, I would have started in September 48, about a fortnight after my fifth birthday. And then after a term in Featherbed Lane Junior School, they opened an infant school very near our house. So I went there then. And what I remember about there is having a difference of opinion with the teacher. And I don't think I kind of invented this. And it was to do with writing the numeral four. And she said, you write four like that, uh-huh. And you don't close it at the top. And I said, on the buses, number four is closed at the top. I still remember that. So I must have been taking note of the buses. Yeah. And it's funny because I Featherbed Lane School. That's different from today. I mean, it was a little way from our house, but, you know, it's just five. Not very big either. you know, I just walked there and back myself. Nobody took me. And I walked back through fields and woods, which are now housing estates. You know, we're actually the last road. The curate's house was the last road before you got into open country, and you had to go across these fields to get. But, you know, there didn't seem to be any worries about.
No, I had a similar experience. I was always taken to the bus stop in the morning, but when I was a little bit older, I would walk back. It was only it was probably about a 30-second walk. I actually went back to the place where I grew up a few months ago, and it seemed so small. But at that age, when I was told, don't go beyond a certain street, and because it felt like that was, you know, in a different county, a different country, and in reality, it was just a few hundred yards. But those were the perceptions.
Yes, yes, yes. And then when I was six, we moved from the town to the village. So I went to the village school. I can remember before we moved, because my father was, well, he was a curate, and then that was when he became a vicar. And I can still remember, I suppose I was just about six and a little bit, going to look at the house and going to look at the village, and then, you know, were we going to go and live there? Mm. And I can still remember meeting one of the women there who was actually a teacher in the primary school and a lifelong friend after that. Mm. And then the village school. And again, playing in the fields and round in the garden and so on. And going to church, going to church a lot. Second nature. And then when I was, this sounds a bit egotistical, really. When I was eight, the village school said they couldn't teach me any more. There was a private school here in Wem, and I was sent here, which involved coming on a bus to and fro, because the village school said that was, I got through that sort of, and then, so I had 2 years in this private school, which I've never regretted, because they're a very good English teacher. It's very old-fashioned, as one did sentence structure, and not just, you know, what's an adverb, what's an adjective, but what are various clauses and all this sort of thing, and how to write a sentence. Which was marvellous. And then in those days there was the 11 plus, and then I got
we still have that in Kent.
Yeah, of course you do. Then I got a place in the grammar school.
I do find
then there
I mean, it's such a different world now. My children those who are at school have started learning phonics. And in fact, I've got some colleagues in linguistics, and I have had to ask one of them, exactly what are we talking about here? Because I certainly didn't learn by sounds. I've always been good at words and disaggregating words. But also, although I know what an adverb is, I can look at a sentence and say, yes, this is grammatically correct, the syntax is perfect, but I wouldn't be able to deconstruct it technically, and yet I'm conscious that in order to learn another language as an adult, I learned ancient Greek at Lampeter in one of the summer schools. And I found that my English grammar wasn't quite, you know, strong enough for me to then be able to look for something in Greek or in Latin if I didn't know what it was in English. Right. And I felt that there was a deficiency perhaps of the system. But at the same time, I thought, well, I'm capable of writing an essay, but why can't I identify a particular gerund? Yeah, yeah.
No, I owe a lot to that, those 2 years when I was 9 and 10, to a very, very traditional, very old-fashioned approach to English, but it stayed with me. I mean, I know what a sentence is. And then, of course, in the grammar school, it did French and Latin, and that reinforced then the idea of grammar. If I approach a language, and I've tried lots of languages, it's through grammar. You know, it's not through these sort of things that my children did in school in Welsh, which is going in ordering coffee or something. So it's actually, you know, how do nouns, adjectives, how do verbs conjugate and so on. I'm happy with grammar, and I think it goes back to that. I was very fortunate, really, and more than that, of course, in the school I went to when I was nine, and I can remember this to this day. My dear wife, who was at that time five, was in the same school. So we go back a long way. Yes. So, yeah, grammar school. And then, the grammar school here was in some ways very like your memories of Lampeter, in that it was a very small school. They're all boys, 17th century foundation. one stream with about 25 boys forms 1 to 5. And then in form 6, this is quite incredible, in form 6 I was the only person doing arts in that year. I mean, I had one-to-one tuition, which I wouldn't have got in Eton.
No, and I went to a very small church in Wales primary school. There must have been no more than, well, I'd say 70 pupils
in the school.
In the school, and my daughters now are in a school with less than 100.
Right.
So you have two-year groups in one, similar to what we do at university by teaching second and third years together. Yeah. But they have that right the way from, well, the reception is single year, and maybe the last year is, I'm not sure, but certainly that they team up with the 2 years of taught together. But it also gives them, I think, a sense of leadership. I've noticed that among the children, that they tend to do better sometimes when they know that they're the older ones in the class. Then the following year they might be the junior ones in the next year up. And so I was talking to the teachers about this. There's a different sense of perception, where, you know, whether you feel that you can mentor the younger ones, or you might feel that you yourself need mentoring. But it's good life skills, I think.
I think so.
Yeah. What about things like music when you were growing up? I mean, what sort of role did, whether it was chart music or contemporary music? I mean, can you remember the sounds from the time?
It wasn't chart music, it wasn't contemporary music. No. It was piano music. I had piano lessons from the age of six, going to Hadnall. Thumped away on the piano. And then in grammar school, 14, 15, I had organ lessons. And in fact, I played the organ in church after that. I'm rusty now, but I actually, last year, the organist here was ill, and I actually took over for a few Sundays, and it came back.
Yeah.
So, but no, musically, I'm very traditional. I wouldn't know the charts at all, I'm afraid. It's lots of Mozart. Lots of Mozart and lots of church music, Stamford and Elgar and so on. Yeah, and my sort of bosom, not bosom, I mean my clone in this is Abigail. I would say that Abigail and I are virtually 100% in agreement on everything.
Yeah.
And music and so on, we're very, very close. So, what else? Sport, no interest whatever, either as a participant or a spectator. And in fact, as far as I could in school, I got out of sport and never regretted it, actually. So what did reading and so on? What else?
What about film? Did film play a role?
Not around here. I used to go to Shrewsbury, of course. There were three cinemas in Shrewsbury. Go there sometimes, but it wasn't a major thing. I suppose in the, and we're talking about grammar school, I went in 54. I suppose for main entertainment then was television. Black and white, one channel. We had one of the first, we got it just before the Queen's coronation, when in 1953. And I think we had one of the first televisions in the village.
So did all the neighbours come around to watch?
Well, they had the coronation.
Yeah, that was my
in the vicarage.
My grandfather's experience.
We had the vicarage, a very big house, a 19th century house. I think they had about 30 people in the house for the coronation, all bringing their own sandwiches. So I would say television was the main source of entertainment throughout my primary and it was radio before that, of course.
Was radio a particular source of
inspiration.
I know you mentioned you were
nothing
growing
else.
Up, you were very young with Welsh. Welsh speaking.
Well, yeah, that went on.
Music. Yes. Well, not necessarily music.
No, Welsh based. Welsh speaking, yes. Welsh Home Service. I found yesterday a diary, actually, 1954. I'm trying to sort this. I mean, it took me 20 years to do this room, but I'm trying to sort things out so that when I go, my children haven't got to go through everything. I found a diary of 1954, and I found several diaries, but they only run from January to about the middle of February, and then obviously I've given up. But there's one, and every night it's Listen to the Archers and Dan Dare. You remember that?
I do.
Radio Luxembourg,
yeah.
It was.
No, the children's radio has been a great source.
205 metres, I think. Yeah. Radio Luxembourg. Down there, Pilot of the Future or something. So, yeah, I was reading that the other day.
Yeah. I mean, so you kept a diary, probably like me, that you'd started.
Well, I had one for Christmas, didn't I?
That's what I did.
And it starts more or less on Christmas Day, because I can't wait for the new year. But by the end of January, it's tailing off.
Yes, I used to make the mistake of writing diary entries during the school half term rather than covering a period that was more representative. And yet, unfortunately, so I'd have lots of sort of October or February half terms. Mm. But because I was off school, the diary entries would consist largely of what I watched on television. And I'm quite embarrassed to read that now, because it's almost as though I was just sitting in front of, watching cartoons.
Mine's got, morning had maths and science and Latin or something, afternoon French and geography. But each year it's no more than 5 or 6 weeks before I obviously packed it in. One great interest was railways. I was very keen on railways. Train spotting. I've still got one of my train spotting books where you underline the numbers of the engines as you saw. Because steam engines then. And the line through here is, Shrewsbury was a very busy station. And it was a joint station, London Midland and Great Western, so you saw lots of different engines. And I used to go off on the train to a place up to Crewe and so on to see the trains. That was a big thing at weekends when in Haddonall, where I lived, the signal box. Every Saturday, three or four locomotives would be sent down from Crewe, where they'd been repaired in the Crewe loco sheds. Just send them down 28 miles to see how they were doing, and they'd stay there for about an hour. And I used to go down on Saturdays and get in the cabs of these engines, or I was allowed. I went in the signal box, and I was allowed to pull the levers and sort of thing. So that was.
Well, my dad worked on the railways.
That was life
for 48 years. He worked on the railways, and yet I went to Lampeter. I had all these free passes.
Oh yeah, so you
chose to go to the one place where there was no railway service.
I went on the last train to go through Lampeter. It was a special. We're all railway circle special up from Carmarthen.
Was that before? Was that before 1970?
No, about 1971, I think.
Ah.
Oddly enough, I have actually got the diary with that in. But I met a friend of mine on it who was a lecturer in English at Leicester, who was mad about railways. Yeah, so I don't know how they'll get with relaying the track. I mean, it's going to be a momentous.
I've heard that. Of course, that comes up.
I mean, it's going now, isn't it? Yeah. Should have done what they do in Ireland, which is, though we tend to laugh at the Irish, if they close a railway line, they leave the track in situ. So that if they need to reopen it, they haven't got bungalows built across the permanent way or marked bypasses. So, yeah, that was school. Was all holidays. Oh, yeah, holidays. Throughout my school days, all holidays were spent in Colwyn Bay, which is where my grandmother lived. And I would go to Colwyn Bay. Do you know North Wales coast?
I went summer of 1988. I remember going on a trip there. Yeah.
Well remembered. Precise. Yeah, my grandmother lived in Colwyn Bay, and every Easter school holidays and throughout the school, the summer holidays, I would spend the whole of those vacations in Colwyn Bay with my grandmother. And then perhaps at Easter, my parents and sister might come for a week and perhaps for a fortnight in the summer. But otherwise, it was just there being spoilt by my grandmother. Mm. Fish and chips every day and going on trains. Going on trains around North Wales. Yes.
Yeah. But what about particular teachers who inspired you? And I guess the same, because we haven't talked about what you did at university, but I'm guessing that you were inspired enough to want to pursue a career. Because in your case, of course, you had an academic career, but also very much a church career. And I don't know which... Because, and, of course, you left Lampeter in 97 to, return to the church. I don't know if that's
No. Well, school teachers. Yeah, school teachers. There were some very good... it was a bit like Lampeter, in fact, exactly like Lampeter, Wem Grammar School. Either teachers stayed for a year and then got another job, or they stayed for their whole lives there. And there were some very... Anthony Evans, who taught to English and history. There were quite a lot of different history teachers, and I think actually that was quite good because they all got different approaches. There was Major Neil, who'd been in the First World War, a very traditionalist, of course, and getting perhaps a little bit old. And then the headmaster, Mr. Foxall, was a historian. And then we had a young historian, John Edwards, who went off to public school, I think. So I had quite a lot of history teachers. There was another one too. What I like most, the subject I did the O levels, or got a nice range of O levels, and managed somehow to get the highest mark in every subject in the class at O level, including art, which I have no skill whatever. In fact, the art master summed up my O level as a triumph of intellect over ability. But anyway, I did a whole range. Then I did history, French, and geography at A level, and history and French at scholarship level too. I think my life would have been quite different if I'd been 2 years younger, or if the headmaster who came when I was halfway through the sixth form had actually come 2 years younger, because he was a modern linguist. And I think if he'd come earlier, or if I'd been younger, I would have done modern languages. So I did French A-level, S-level, and I did Russian O-level. And if I'd had just one more year, I think I would have done Russian A level, and then done Russian, French, and Russian at university.
So what stands out particularly from those years?
I remember when I was about 12, the then headmaster and my father had a row as to whether I should go to Oxford or Cambridge. I mean, I was seen, I think, as a high flyer, and yeah, I remember going up to Oxford and sitting the entrance exam in history at Keble. And then getting a letter saying, we're delighted to offer you a place, but we hope you'll come back in January and sit the scholarship examination. Mm-hmm. So I did, and I got an open scholarship. The first one from Wem Grammar School since 1932, I think, to Keble College, Oxford. And it's funny, I went to Oxford. I thought, I'm grown up now. I've left school. And I put my belongings in a trunk, I think, and I went on the train because I thought you didn't, that was the way to go. That was the great way to go to university. And I think every other single person I saw there, parents had brought them, in cars to. But anyway, I was very happy there. I thought on my first evening in Keble, I thought I'm in the right place. Mm. This is, school. I found a bit petty. The rules and things, but I thought this.
And something has just come to mind because you taught me in my first year, and we were looking at I think the module was on the Vietnam War, and you were running the seminars, but you were talking about the Cuban Missile Crisis. And did that coincide with when you went to university?
It did. Yeah. It did.
So that's come back to me from
October 62.
Yeah.
I think I was so caught up in being in the opening weeks at university that I wasn't really following the news. But I do remember, I got very involved in College Chapel from the start. I do remember that we actually had some sort of prayer meeting on, I think, when the crisis was at its most acute, threat of nuclear war. And that was October 62, yeah, that's when I just got there. So, there were three history lecturers, and all of them I greatly admired. Eric Stone, who was a medievalist, and Douglas Price, who did early modern, and Alec Campbell, who did modern. And, I owe a lot to them, an awful lot to them. Particularly perhaps Eric Stone, who made one question everything. Mm. And I still find it almost impossible to come down and, to decide on any issue that's right, because I can see both sides. Mm. Or if somebody makes some remark, you know, only 70% of people or something do this. Well, I think, 30% didn't. And immediately, that was Eric, I think, who got me thinking like that. And Douglas Price, very traditional Englishman. Campbell, American history, really. my hero was the warden of the college, Austin Farrer. And if you come across...
I have come across that name Austin in Farrer. Theology circles.
Yeah.
Did he teach you?
No. But he offered me marvellous advice. There's a new book, in fact, I've got it over there, by Rowan Williams, called Christ, the Heart of Creation. And Rowan Williams wrote that Austin Farrer was the most outstanding theologian of his century. And he died 50 years ago, next Saturday. Mm. And there is a rule in the Church of England that apart from those who are killed for their faith, they can be considered to go into the calendar of the church after 50 years after they've died. Mm. And actually, I had a letter published yesterday in the Church Times saying Austin Farrer died on the 29th of December 1968. And so this is a plea that this great, not just a great theologian, but a very godly man, you know, should be commemorated in the calendar of the Church of England. So I'm waiting to see now. But I've had a couple of emails saying, well done, supporting, thinking he was. But yes, he was a tremendous influence, Austin Farrer. Very humble, very shy man, but I can still hear him speaking.
Mm. I immediately think of philosophy of religion, theodicy questions. Is that his area?
Causation. Yeah. Mm. He did biblical commentaries too, but they're very eccentric. And he didn't like footnotes. Mm. He didn't have footnotes. But I can still hear his voice. And he once said to me, you and I, William, are birds of a feather. And I've always remembered that. Mm. Bird of a feather with Austin Farrer. And I used to write home every week. I mean, they had phones then, but letters were in there.
It was no different in the early 90s.
And it's probably not a very good idea, actually, but I've actually destroyed most of the letters when I'm trying to tidy this bureau. Mm. But one or two I've kept, including my reports to my parents of conversations with Austin Farrer.
Yeah.
Such as Austin Farrer said to me, we are birds of a feather. Or Austin Farrer said, don't get ordained. So I've been an ordinand for my whole life, I think. But he said, don't get ordained straight away, and don't go to any selection conference. Wait until they invite you to be ordained. I remember him saying that. And you don't want to be a curate, because nobody knows what to do with curates. And it's sort of very down-to-earth advice, actually. Mm. Which I valued greatly.
No, I found that those letters, which I do still have, in fact, when I saw my parents last Christmas, they gave me all the letters that I'd written to them.
Yeah.
And I spent the first few months of 2018 incorporating them, writing them up and incorporating them into my diary. And it had a use a few months ago, because so I was asked if I could contribute to an article on the Lampeter, the floods in 1992, would have been around December 92.
Mm, I remember.
And I remember thinking, well, I remember that, but I've got no corroborating evidence, but I didn't really keep much of a diary in those days. And there is a photograph from that period, but I couldn't pin the date down. But then in the letter I referred to, I wrote to my parents telling them, don't worry, you know, Burgess Hall is still standing. But on the basis of that, I was able to piece together enough to write a few hundred words, but priceless, you know, at the time they were written often, but full of very incidental details about books not being in the library or particular lectures that I went to. You know, on one level, why would I be telling my parents this? But now it's almost a letter to myself.
That's right.
Because all these years it gives me a picture. And also, importantly, shows that a lot of my memories from that period, although perhaps to an extent distorted, or you lose a sense of perspective sometimes, but generally pretty accurate. And it almost then corroborates or vindicates my sense of this is what went on. It's not me putting, you know, a particular gloss on a period. You know, the things that I remember in a very positive way really did happen. And here's the evidence.
Yes, I think it's within the last 3 weeks, actually, I got rid of most of these letters. I found them interesting, but of course I was writing what I wanted my parents to think, you know, and I'm not entirely sure how factual they were, you know, or particularly going out with girls or something, but... I don't know. But anyway, I just kept the ones of my reports to them of my conversations with Austin Farrow, which might well be what I thought Austin Farrow said, or what I would have liked Austin Farrow to have said, possibly, rather than what he did say. But somehow,
but it sounds like you're going to find a use for those in terms of what you're doing now with the 50th anniversary of his death. It sounds as though you might want to use those almost in a sermon or in a letter. It sounds as though you've got something brewing.
I did give a lecture on him not long ago in Lichfield, actually, as a priest and a scholar and a genius. I mean, I think I finished up by saying I've met some geniuses and I've met some saints, but I've never met anybody else who quite was both a genius and a saint. Anyway, sorry.
No, not at all.
Where have we got to? I've got to Keeble, yes.
But I was just thinking in terms of, you know, wider questions, which obviously they can refer to your time at university or your career since, but would you say that your memories are predominantly positive? That's the big nostalgia question about how we look at the past through a particular lens, rose-coloured or otherwise, or bittersweet, perhaps.
Yeah, some things. Yeah, there are things, some things perhaps I'd try to not to dwell on or to forget. That would be some personal relationships, for instance, you know, which hadn't gone too well. And that's a long time ago. No, they're positive. They're very positive in my childhood and school, though the petty rules in school did annoy me, and very much so of Keeble. And in county history too, when I was doing these evening classes and so on, and then Lampeter, and then getting married, and then the family. I got ordained. I'd been in Lampeter about 2 years, and everybody sort of... I went to chapel, and I was a lay reader too, and people said, I think you should get ordained. And I wrote to the Bishop of St David's, Eric Roberts, about this, and said I was willing to do the course and, you know, take a bit longer over it for ordination while I was teaching. It's before I got married again. I went to see him in Abergwilly near Carmarthen, the bishop's house, and I came out and he said, I'll ordain you next in the summer if you just do a couple of essays. So I was ordained. I think it was because partly because by then my Welsh was pretty perfect, and there were a great shortage of clergy around Lampeter.
Mm. So which year would this have been?
Well, I was deacon in 72, mm. priest in 73. And that's another letter, actually, which I was reading only yesterday, from Bishop Eric Roberts in his retirement. And he said, it wasn't he who did me a favour by ordaining me, it was I who did a favour by being willing to be ordained and to look and to do church work. So that's the one I'll keep. I'm not tearing that up. So then I helped out a lot in chaff. Sometimes I was chaplain for a bit and then not. And then 1986, after my mother died, and my father died before that, in 1986, the archdeacon came round and sitting in Brindilis car park, said, would I look after the church of Betus Bledrus? Do you know Betus Bledrus, Derry Ormond, just north of Lampeter on the Tregaron Road? You probably wouldn't need to go that way.
No, maybe not.
Would I look after Betus Bledrus Church for a few weeks till they could sort out, do something permanent? And I said yes. And I looked after it unpaid for 11 years for Betus Bledrus, and built it up, actually. I'm very happy. And then... So I've had these, and during that time too, I was made a canon of St David's Cathedral. So I have really, ridden two horses, academic and clerical, from 1972 onwards. And I do wonder occasionally, had I stuck to one horse, whether I might have got right to the top, rather than. Almost to the top, in two, you know. If I stuck at academe, would I have been at least a reader, if not a... Well, I said it would have been a professor, wouldn't I? Because the, as far as I can gather in Lampeter, if you had two books published, you got a chair. And I've beaten that by a long way. Or if I'd been on the clerical side, would I've been a bishop? I never know. I was offered an archdeaconry, and I turned it down in January 1993 on the grounds I'd never actually been in a parish. I'd never actually been a stipendiary cleric, and I would find it very difficult to deal with curates and vicars, never having actually been paid by the church. And I didn't want to be an archdeacon because I'm not good at discipline anyway. I'm always, if people do things sort of to hurt me, I'll be the one who apologises. I'm just hopeless. So, but if I'd become an archdeacon, then I might well have been Bishop of Bangor, in which case I would have had white hair pretty quickly. So there's this riding these two horses. But in the end, I've actually, without possibly getting to the very top, I've done, senior lecturer and residential canon is more than most do, even in one. And they've played off against another. But there came a point by 1996, because I got a full load in college. I think I was deputy head of department and doing an awful lot, actually. I was college archivist too, and sometimes with the chapel. And then I got Betus Bledrus Church, and I was a canon in the cathedral. That's quite a lot of work. I was on the diocesan faculties committee. I was on the diocesan churches committee. I was going down to Carmarthen every other week. And I just thought I've got to do one rather than the other. And so I chose the church. Not out of dissatisfaction with the university, but because I felt by then that I couldn't go on doing almost two full-time jobs. And I've never regretted that decision. And subsequently, particularly after retirement, I found I have been able to do some more lecturing and writing. But I think actually, once the clerical and the academic sort of enhanced each other, really.
Mm. You just reminded me of Tony Benn, who said when he ceased being an MP in 2001 that he was leaving Westminster to devote more time to politics.
Yes, I remember that. Yeah. I remember that. So, yes, I think... And in a sense, even when I was a lecturer, I mean, being a cleric as well, I probably dealt with more pastoral problems from students than perhaps other lecturers would have done.
Yes. Yeah, because I'm the senior tutor in the school where I'm based, and I would say that the pastoral care of students is certainly equal with the amount of time spent teaching or researching, and it's a pleasure. So I have the privilege of having almost three jobs in one, sometimes more than that with various other recruitment, for example, type activities. But and also with the podcast now, for example, it does feel that I'm wearing lots of different hats. But if anything, I find sometimes they do just about fit together. But occasionally I feel stretched.
I felt that. And I always insisted, I mean, on living in Lampeter, well, because the children were in Lampeter school and so on, but I mean, I had some colleagues who lived in Carmarthen or even further away and were only ever seen when they were teaching, you know. And were you there when Baron Duckham was Professor of History?
No, I think he must have gone by then.
He took early retirement. He had a very bad back. I remember one VAC, and he said, the VAC's coming up now. He said, those who live in Lampeter can look after the shop or something, you know, and those staff who didn't live in Lampeter wouldn't be expected to be in Lampeter. But we had virtually every year with finals, quite often we had students who actually came to live in our house, and she mothered them sort of through their finals. It wasn't just 9 to 5 or... It was all the time.
I feel that if my job were sort of 9 to 5, then I probably would be looking at the clock thinking, oh, you know, why am I here? But because it isn't, I'm there longer. It's the same with holidays. Because I don't have a statutory holiday provision, I spend more of my year in work than perhaps I would do if there was a contract that said, you know, you're entitled to be off for a certain amount of time. So I think there's something very vocational about the academy. I mean, not for everyone.
Oh, yeah, I think that's right.
I think that's the word
I was looking for, yes. Mm. Yes, that's right. It isn't for everyone.
No.
It isn't, certainly not. It was not even in Lampeter.
And I think that although inevitably some people get appointed on the basis of research, I think day to day there are students often knocking at our door saying, can you help? And I think that therefore the question is, you know, what is one's calling? I think it is a calling, actually. To appropriate what would be a more suitable terminology in the clerical profession.
But there is the research business is... I can think of at least two people whose pastoral work was nil, really, and whose appearances in Lampeter were quite infrequent. Mm. The cancelling lectures or just coming up sort of once a week from somewhere. And then, you know, I think two people in particular, both of whom got chairs in major universities. Because they were writing, when I was interviewed in the summer of 1970 for a lectureship in Lampeter, research, or the word I prefer is publication or scholarship, wasn't mentioned. It was just teaching, and I remember the principal Lloyd Thomas. He said. Slog, he said, for the first 2 years you'll be writing lectures, but after that it gets much easier. But nothing about publishing at all. No, it was and two of my sort of heroes from Keble, Eric Stone and Douglas Price, neither wrote a book, you know, an article. I think each of them wrote an article, and that's about it. But they were college men, you know, and any trouble one could go and see them any time.
Well, I think
and social activities in college, they were there.
No, I've seen the culture change just in the last 10 or 15 years. Appointments would be made on the basis of research, even a decade ago, and promotions would be on the basis of research primarily. But now, we talk much more now about recruitment because we know that no matter how much income will come in from external grants, students, now that they're paying their own fees, we are at the mercy of the number of students. You know, if the students don't come to us, then there is a significant hole in our finances. Yeah. Yeah. So we know that, whereas once upon a time it might be a case of who's doing clearing this year, it's a case that, you know, the person doing clearing, obviously we have, we're not completely dependent on clearing, but it just goes to show how important it is to make sure that throughout the whole year, we are looking after the student's purse, as it were, or our purse is very much dependent on the student. So you can write the most wonderful books and articles, but unless you've got the students to teach, then, you know, you may not have a job at the end of of a few years.
And there's a declining number, isn't there? This business about the proportion of firsts now, which is in today's paper. There's one university, it's 50% get firsts. This seems odd.
I've got two more questions.
Right.
One I think you've already answered, because it was whether you feel that you fulfilled the dreams you had when you were young, or whether you entertain thoughts about doing something different with your life that may be in keeping with what you dreamt about at school or university. But having the two hats, I think in a way it sounds as though you almost managed to do the two things that were your passion. You were a university lecturer and you were in the church, but you actually held them together almost symbiotically, but to the point when you had to make a decision
for 25 years
that you needed to choose one over the other.
And if I had my time again, I think I'd try to do the same. I don't think I'd want to be a full-time vicar for my whole career, because the church is just collapsing, really. And I'm not sure if I'd want to be a full-time academic either.
So you had the best of both.
And that's what I would try to do. Though perhaps I let the demands of both. Well, I mean, the academic side is what I was paid for. And it did get more demanding. I mean, with reviews and that sort of thing. Appraisals. There's none of that when I started. I mean, it was just a society of scholars, really. Some of whom I know did virtually nothing. And others who worked hard, but there was
these days we have WAM points, workload allocation model. So you'd get points for each task or role that you perform.
No, well, I think when I started, I mean, I think there was, the first year was probation, and after that, until the 80s anyway, there was nothing really. Got on with it. Or there were certainly colleagues who had pretty leisurely lives.
But also I find those colleagues sometimes never seem to be very happy either.
No.
That sometimes those who on the, some people say to me sometimes, oh, you must be looking forward to your next period of study leave. And on one level I am, because actually it gives me a little chance to step back and focus on one area that needs to be cultivated because of other demands in previous years. But I do think sometimes that being there all the time, being in an office every day regularly, means that you can really appreciate the culture and imbibe it rather than feel that you're just a commuter. And I think I learned that at Lampeter, for example, having reconnected with an old undergraduate friend recently. We were commenting on how we never missed a lecture, but if we had have missed it, nobody would have told us off. Nobody was taking a register, but we were there at university to study. So, you know, it wasn't a case of, where would we be
not
at 10 in the morning?
Not everybody was that conscientious, I must say. Yeah. And I think both academic and clerical, one of the great pluses is of both the academic life and the clerical is that no day's the same, and you're dealing with people. Yeah. Younger people in university, but older people in the church. Yeah. But you're dealing with, and you're not just going into an office at 9 o'clock and... Yeah. on your own until five or whatever, you're dealing with human beings.
And I even found that this week, because it's just a few days to Christmas, and I thought, right, I've got the chance to read a PhD thesis that I need to examine. Not a chance. And actually no bad thing, because I went in with a view to doing something and I got other things done in its place that perhaps took priority. But at least it kept me very busy. I could never sort of go in and say, oh, I've got nothing to do, if anything.
I think
last time I remember saying to somebody I was bored was at the age of four in primary school, and the teacher then told us off. You know, she said, well, if you're bored, don't worry, I'll find you something to do. So after that, we were never bored. but yeah, and it's funny sometimes that the world comes to you. Often the students come with a whole set of different concerns, and then you help them, and you realise before you know it that you know your day has been taken up in a whole range of areas.
That's right.
But that's far more fulfilling sometimes than simply saying, I'm going to write that chapter, and if anybody knocks on my door, I'll either shout at them or bolt it from within.
And the other thing is I'm mentally still very curious. Very, very curious. I mean, I've been... I've mentioned this. I've been retired virtually 11 years in this house. You know, there's just one example of this. I mean, this is how I don't waste my time, but keep my mind active. There's been a series of programmes about life on a farm in Yorkshire on television that Alison, for some reason, has recorded, and I've been watching. And it's a very remote place, Ravenseat. I couldn't find it on the map for a bit, and then yesterday I found it on the map, and then I went on Google Earth to see it, and then I wanted to see where the nearest church was, and then what benefits that church, Mooka, what benefits that was in Swaledale, and then who was the vicar, then I had Crockford's clerical directory, what were the vicar's qualifications, and one thing leads to another, you know, and the result is only personal satisfaction, but I've got this. The Crockford's clerical directory is there. There's 70 altogether. I don't know what to do with them. I might ask you that in a minute. But I will go to 1934 and see, you know, who was vicar of so and so, then just get lost in that. And I think I'm still very curious about. Academic, you know, history.
And I think really. The concept of retirement does. There are some professions, I mean, you have this with politicians in their 70s and 80s who don't retire. And if they did stop working, well, they probably would stop completely. You know, I mean, the whole point is that if you're an inquisitive person.
That's right.
That's why you have people like Ken Clark in his late 70s still, you know, well, obviously now father of the House of Commons.
Now, I'm asking myself questions all the time. And inquisitive about things.
But my very last question, but in a way, I think you've answered this one as well. Would you consider yourself to be a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
Oh, I look forward. I look forward, you know, remembering the past, and probably most of the time blocking out the bits of the past that weren't. It wasn't all utopia. But just thinking of the best bits. I mean, the best. What now is. What am I, 75? I mean, I don't know how long. I've just become chairman of the Shropshire Historic Churches Trust. I mean, I haven't stopped, you know, and I take services in church and so on, and I give lectures. So I'm still very busy, and I certainly want to go on doing that for as long as I can. But obviously what we haven't really talked about is I suppose, the centre of things, the family. In, you know, I've got a great wife of 46 years now who is a nurse, and not an academic, but very sensible, down to earth. We're complementary, I think. And three children and four grandchildren, you know, and they are the centre of my life now, really. Next week I'll see them all. My older daughter Claire lives in Shrewsbury, so they're just a quarter of an hour away. Two boys, Harry and Sam. Harry had a liver has had two liver transplants. He's fine now. He's 7 and a half, but we've had a rough time there. And then my son Michael is not married, and lives near Chester, and he's on his way back from Lanzarote from 10 days holiday on his own. Landing at 7, I think. And then Abigail lives in Exeter with her two daughters, and they're coming tomorrow. It's a pity you couldn't. Mm, but it wouldn't. I think Christmas Eve would have been too busy.
Yeah.
But that's again. And they are the centre of my sort of life, I suppose, at the moment. Yeah. And we'll go on being, really. Mm. Seeing them. Seeing particularly the four of them growing up.
Yeah,
so yeah, I look forward. But recalling the past. And on the whole, no regrets. Shouldn't have regrets, yeah.
It has been such a privilege, I think, after so many years to reconnect and find that you are still so active, so curious, so inquisitive. So thank you very much, William Price.